Welcome. This evening, we finish our reading of Chapter 15, Reality and the Integral Knowledge. I note first that this is the 26th of March, which is the birth date of Dr. Robert Kleinman, whom so many knew and drew inspiration from, a pioneer in America with Sri Aurobindo's vision. And of course, a close friend and mentor to many of us. To this point, in these last few pages, Sri Aurobindo has been examining the nature of reality, and what is it really that we wish to know? Can we know it merely through subjectivity? Must we know it merely through objectivity? Recognizing that there are different standards of knowledge, Sri Aurobindo presses the case that we must move forward to an integral knowledge, one that grasps not only the form but the essence behind. So we pick up, he will use a term almost immediately, the a priori, and let's just understand that that means from what is prior, and also obscurantism, another term which means opposition to inquiry or reform. In other words, what is covered over. Let's leave it covered over and therefore make it obscure. So, he begins, to refuse to inquire upon any general ground preconceived and a priori is an obscurantism as prejudicial to the extension of knowledge as the religious obscurantism which opposed in Europe the extension of scientific discovery. The greatest inner discoveries, the experience of self-being, the cosmic consciousness, the inner calm of the liberated spirit, the direct effect of mind upon mind, the knowledge of things by consciousness in direct contact with other consciousness or with its objects, most spiritual experiences of any value cannot be brought before the tribunal of the common mentality, which has no experience of these things and takes its own absence or incapacity of experience as a proof of their invalidity or their non-existence. So it is interesting that he immediately turns to the nature of valid self-experience, both of self and experience of cosmos, and of the one being that both is or are. These things are too profound to be subject to the limited puny grasp of physicality, which describes only a fringe part of the nature, most of which is hidden as it is manifest by the Supreme. The nature that we know is only almost an exoskeleton. It is not the real substance of the being of nature. If we try to judge simply from externalities, we cannot know anything deeply. We will only know the superficies of existence. So the correlation of physical phenomena through measurement, as described in matter, cannot convict spiritual truths of insubstantiality. They simply cannot know. He continues, physical truth, or formulas, generalizations, discoveries founded upon physical observation can be so referred. But even there, a training of capacity is needed before one can truly understand and judge. It is not every untrained mind that can follow the mathematics of relativity or other difficult scientific truths or judge of the validity either of their result or their process. All reality, all experience must indeed, to be held as true, be capable of verification by a same or similar experience. So, in fact, all men can have a spiritual experience and can follow it out and verify it in themselves, but only when they have acquired the capacity or can follow the inner methods by which that experience and verification are made possible. This is a universal dictum of science, whether we're talking about the inner sciences or the outer sciences. What you speak about, what you present as evidence, ought to be verifiable. Another, psychologically, should be able to take up the same methods with the same rigor and arrive at the same result. This is true in the physical sciences in ascertaining whether a theory is correct or not, and it ought to be applied with the same vigor to the inner world. But you see, again, he underscores here experience as the real validation. It is necessary to dwell for a moment on these obvious and elementary truths because the opposite ideas have been sovereign in a recent period of human mentality. They are now only receding and have stood in the way of the development of a vast domain of possible knowledge. Remember, he's writing here in the late 30s, you might say the earliest part of the early 40s. I think we can say that they did not continue that momentum of recession. They have rather reasserted themselves. It is of supreme importance for the human spirit to be free to sound the depths of inner or subliminal reality, of spiritual and of what is still superconscient reality, and not to immure itself in the physical mind and its narrow domain of objective external solidities. For in that way alone can there come liberation from the ignorance in which our mentality dwells, and a release into a complete consciousness, a true and integral self-realization and self-knowledge. So we must have the freedom to inquire, and to inquire without fear of a priori negative judgment into those superphysical realities. We must gain access to them by experience if we can gain access to them through no other way. If there is no physical instrument by which we can assess and sound out their truths, then it is the direct apprehension of our consciousness which must be, in this case, the investigator and the judge. He continues, an integral knowledge demands an exploration, an unveiling of all the possible domains of consciousness and experience. For there are subjective domains of our being which lie behind the obvious surface. These have to be fathomed, and whatever is ascertained must be admitted within the scope of the total reality. An inner range of spiritual experience is one very great domain of human consciousness. It has to be entered into up to its deepest depths and its vastest reaches. The supraphysical is as real as the physical, To know it is part of a complete knowledge. Complete knowledge equates with integral knowledge. The knowledge of the superphysical has been associated with mysticism and occultism, and occultism has been banned as a superstition and a fantastic error. Remember, occult merely means hidden. So these are explorations of the inner world. Now, it's true that emerging from the late 19th century and into the early 20th century, a lot of what was taken as spiritualism was debunked, and rightfully debunked. There was a lot of nonsense written about the worlds hidden to our external view, but that does not mean that it is all error. We have to be capable of a sound investigation and of a most penetrating vision and of a vast, capacious consciousness which can hold these things, digest them, and fashion them into intelligible theory, which can then be investigated by others coming behind us and verified. Continuing, but the occult is a part of existence. A true occultism means no more than a research into superphysical realities and an unveiling of the hidden laws of being and nature, of all that is not obvious on the surface. It attempts the discovery of the secret laws of mind and mental energy, the secret laws of life and life energy, the secret laws of the subtle physical and its energies, all that nature has not put into visible operation on the surface. It pursues also the application of these hidden truths and powers of nature so as to extend the mastery of the human spirit beyond the ordinary operations of mind, the ordinary operations of life, the ordinary operations of our physical existence. So not only to know, but to do, to be able to harness the knowledge of these inner realms, mind, life, and body, and then to apply those discovered energies in focused activity to gain and demonstrate mastery of said provinces. In the spiritual domain, he writes, which is occult to the surface mind, insofar as it passes beyond normal and enters into supernormal experience, there is possible not only the discovery of the self and spirit, but the discovery of the uplifting, informing, and guiding light of spiritual consciousness and the power of the spirit, the spiritual way of knowledge, the spiritual way of action. Remember, this grounds back to chit. The nature of chit is not simply consciousness, sheer consciousness, but also power, shakti. Chit shakti is the nature of that second principle that we talk about with respect to sat chit ananda. It's sat, sheer, true existence, but a conscious existence whose nature is power and whose experience of the self-deployings of that power is delight. To know these things and to bring their truths and forces into the life of humanity is a necessary part of its evolution. Science itself is in its own way an occultism, for it brings to light the formulas which nature has hidden, and it uses its knowledge to set free operations of her energies, which she has not included in her ordinary operations, and to organize and place at the service of man her occult powers and processes, a vast system of physical magic, For there is and can be no other magic than the utilization of secret truths of being, secret powers and processes of nature. It may even be found that a supraphysical knowledge is necessary for the completion of physical knowledge, because the processes of physical nature have behind them a supraphysical factor, a power and action, mental, vital, or spiritual, which is not tangible to any outer means of knowledge. All insistence on the soul or the fundamental validity of the objective real takes its stand on the sense of the basic reality of matter. But it is now evident that matter is by no means fundamentally real. It is a structure of energy. It is becoming even a little doubtful whether the acts and creations of this energy itself are explicable except as the motions of power of a secret mind or consciousness, of which its processes and steps of structure are the formulas. It is, therefore, no longer possible to take matter as the sole reality. So you follow this. Matter is concretized energy. Energy is conceptive, that is, it is conceived from a consciousness. The conception becomes energetic, the energism becomes material in form. He continues, the material interpretation of existence was the result of an exclusive concentration, a preoccupation with one movement of existence, and such an exclusive concentration has its utility and is therefore permissible. In recent times, it has justified itself by the many immense and the innumerable minute discoveries of physical science. But a solution of the whole problem of existence cannot be based on an exclusive one-sided knowledge. We must know not only what matter is and what are its processes, but what mind and life are, and what are their processes. And one must know also spirit and soul and all that is behind the material surface. Only then can we have a knowledge sufficiently integral for a solution of the problem. For the same reason, those views of existence which arise from an exclusive or predominant preoccupation with mind or with life and regard mind or life as the sole fundamental reality have not a sufficiently wide basis for acceptance. Such a preoccupation of exclusive concentration may lead to a fruitful scrutiny which sheds much light on mind and life, but cannot result in a total solution of the problem. So, we cannot grant that physical science has got the ultimate answers about the nature of the larger universe. It grasps at the externalities. We cannot cede to, let's say, psychology that from its inner experience and valuations that we can appreciate what has been formed in matter or from which mind comes from above. It too is insufficient. The Bergsonian interpretation of life as a creative power which drives all existence also is insufficient, because each of these philosophic positions, each of these approaches to knowledge, is partial and does not arrive at integrality, cannot explain all the other parts of nature. We need one view in which all this is well grounded. I may have read this sentence before. Let me read it again if I have. It may very well be that an exclusive or predominant concentration on the subliminal being, regarding the surface existence as a mere system of symbols for an expression of its soul reality, might throw a strong light on the subliminal and its processes, and extend vastly the powers of the human being, but it would not be by itself an integral solution or lead us successfully to the integral knowledge of reality. So the subliminal, like any other thing taken as a piece, cannot supply the entirety of an integral knowledge. Even though each speaks a truth, it is not a concordant truth. In our view, the spirit, the self, is the fundamental reality of existence. But an exclusive concentration on this fundamental reality, to the exclusion of all reality of mind, life, or matter, except as an imposition on the self, or unsubstantial shadows cast by the spirit, might help to an independent and radical spiritual realization, but not to an integral and valid solution of the truth of cosmic and individual existence. So you see what he's done here. From matter, you can see a bit of the entire truth. It is insufficient. Look from the realm of life, look from the realm of mind. Those positions also are inadequate. They're partial. Look from inside, from the subliminal worlds, the inner mind, the inner life, the inner physical. That too is only partial. None of these supply a well-grounded total truth. Even if we leave all of these ranges of manifest being behind and retire into the reality of the self from which all comes, that too, by dint of its exclusion of nature, is not an integral knowledge. This too is not sufficient to explain how spirit manifests. To simply cancel the manifestation is no explanation of the manifestation. An integral knowledge, then, must be a knowledge of the truth of all sides of existence, both separately and in the relation of each to all, and the relation of all to the truth of the Spirit. Our present state is an ignorance and a many-sided seeking. It seeks for the truth of all things, but, as is evident from the insistence and the variety of the human mind's speculations as to the fundamental truth which explains all others, the reality at the basis of all things, the fundamental truth of things, their basic reality, must be found in some at once fundamental and universal real. It is that which, once discovered, must embrace and explain all, for, that being known, all will be known. The fundamental real must necessarily be and contain the truth of all existence, the truth of the individual, the truth of the universe, the truth of all that is beyond the universe. Yes, good memory if you noted that this thing, which is in quotes here, that being known, all will be known. This is an echo from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad 2, 4, 5, and also from the Mundaka Upanishad 1, 1, 3. So that first sentence, an integral knowledge, then, must be a knowledge of the truth of all sides of existence, both separately and in the relation of each to all, and the relation of all to the truth of the Spirit. All is grounded in that all-transcending self, but it is also an all-manifesting self. In all the levels of reality, must be perceived and known in their interpenetration, in their coalescence, in their harmonic expression, in the universe, in the individual, in all things. He continues, the mind, in seeking for such a reality and testing each thing from matter upwards to see if that might not be it, has not proceeded on a wrong intuition. All that is necessary is to carry the inquiry to its end and test the highest and ultimate levels of experience. So we've begun well. This is the spirit of science, to ruthlessly, indefatigably test these things against a larger and larger framework of truth, because we will outgrow our ignorance if we will keep pressing. But since it is from the ignorance that we proceed to the knowledge, we have had first to discover the secret nature and full extent of the ignorance. And lo, we have spent the last several chapters analyzing it to its depths. If we look at this ignorance in which we ordinarily... I'll start again. If we look at this ignorance in which ordinarily we live by the very circumstance of our separative existence in a material, in a spatial and temporal universe, we see that on its obscurer side, it reduces itself from whatever direction we look at or approach it into the fact of a many-sided self-ignorance. We are ignorant of the Absolute, which is the source of all being and becoming. We take partial facts of being, temporal relations of the becoming, for the whole truth of existence. That is the first, the original ignorance. We are ignorant of the spaceless, timeless, immobile, and immutable self. We take the constant mobility and mutation of the cosmic becoming in time and space for the whole truth of existence. That is the second, the cosmic ignorance. We are ignorant of our universal self, the cosmic existence, the cosmic consciousness, our infinite unity with all being and becoming. We take our limited egoistic mentality, vitality, corporeality for our true self and regard everything other than that as not self. That is the third, the egoistic ignorance. We are ignorant of our eternal becoming in time. We take this little life in a small span of time, in a petty field of space, for our beginning, our middle, and our end. That is the fourth, the temporal ignorance. Even within this brief temporal becoming, we are ignorant of our large and complex being, of that in us which is superconscient, subconscient, intraconscient, circumconscient to our surface becoming. We take that surface becoming with its small selection of overtly mentalized experiences for our whole existence. That is the fifth, the psychological ignorance. We are ignorant of the true constitution of our becoming. We take the mind or life or body or any two of these or all three for our true principle or the whole account of what we are, losing sight of that which constitutes them and determines by its occult presence and is meant to determine sovereignly by its emergence their operations, that is the sixth, the constitutional ignorance. As a result of all these ignorances, we miss the true knowledge, government, and enjoyment of our life in the world. We are ignorant in our thought, will, sensations, actions, return wrong or imperfect responses at every point to the questionings of the world. wander in a maze of errors and desires, strivings and failures, pain and pleasure, sin and stumbling, follow a crooked road, grope blindly for a changing goal. That is the seventh, the practical ignorance. Our conception of the ignorance will necessarily determine our conception of the knowledge, and determine, therefore, since our life is the ignorance at once denying and seeking after the knowledge, the goal of human effort and the aim of the cosmic endeavor. Integral knowledge will then mean the canceling of the sevenfold ignorance by the discovery of what it misses and ignores. A sevenfold self-revelation within our consciousness. It will mean the knowledge of the Absolute as the origin of all things, the knowledge of the Self, the Spirit, the Being, and of the Cosmos as the Self's becoming, the becoming of the Being, a manifestation of the Spirit. The knowledge of the world as one with us in the consciousness of our true self, thus canceling our division from it by the separative idea and life of ego. The knowledge of our psychic entity and its immortal persistence in time beyond death and earth existence. The knowledge of our greater and inner existence behind the surface. The knowledge of our mind, life, and body in its true relation to the self within, and the superconscient, spiritual, and supramental being above them. The knowledge, finally, of the true harmony and true use of our thought, will, and action, and a change of all our nature into a conscious expression of the truth of the Spirit, the Self, the Divinity, the integral spiritual reality. But this is not an intellectual knowledge which can be learned and completed in our present mold of consciousness. It must be an experience. A becoming, a change of consciousness, a change of being. This brings in the evolutionary character of the becoming and the fact that our mental ignorance is only a stage in our evolution. The integral knowledge, then, can only come by an evolution of our being and our nature, and that would seem to signify a slow process in time, such as has accompanied the other evolutionary transformations. But, as against that inference, there is the fact that the evolution has now become conscious, and its method and steps need not be altogether of the same character as when it was subconscious in its process. The integral knowledge, since it must result from a change of consciousness, can be gained by a process in which our will and endeavor have a part, in which they can discover and apply their own steps and method. Its growth in us can proceed by a conscious self-transformation. It is necessary, then, to see what is likely to be the principle of this new process of evolution and what are the movements of the integral knowledge that must necessarily emerge in it. Or, in other words, what is the nature of the consciousness that must be the base of the life divine, and how that life may be expected to be formed or to form itself, to materialize or, as one might say, to realize. So the sevenfold knowledge replaces the sevenfold ignorance through the practice of an integral yoga, which equates with the evolution of the spirit in the human to exceed its current formula. The next chapter is titled The Integral Knowledge and the Aim of Life, Four Theories of Existence. Now, it's interesting. In the Arya, the chapter that he just wrote would leap next to a chapter called The Progress to Knowledge. For us, that's a bit away. This next chapter that we'll look at was chapter 50 in the Arya. Remember, he was going from 32 to 33. So there's a great deal that Sri Aurobindo wants to cover before we get back to this chapter, which he will title The Progress to Knowledge. And his full explanation and analysis of the sevenfold ignorance and the resolution that comes from a sevenfold knowledge is also a bit of distance from us. He has first things to look at, these four theories of existence, the nature of evolution, etc. So, there's much to examine and much to enjoy in the coming months. This chapter is complete. I'd like to end our time together in this session with a reading from Savitri. This is from Book 7, The Book of Yoga, Canto 7, The Cosmic Spirit and Cosmic Consciousness. Her spirit saw the world as living God. It saw the One and knew that all was He. She knew Him as the absolute self-space, one with herself and ground of all things here, in which the world wanders seeking for the truth, guarded behind its face of ignorance. She followed Him through the march of endless time. All nature's happenings were events in her. The heartbeats of the cosmos were her own. All beings thought and felt and moved in her. She inhabited the vastness of the world. Its distances were her nature's boundaries, its closenesses her own life's intimacies. Her mind became familiar with its mind. Its body was her body's larger frame, in which she lived and knew herself in it, one, multitudinous in its multitudes. She was a single being, yet all things. The world was her spirit's wide circumference. The thoughts of others were her intimates, their feelings close to her universal heart, their bodies, her many bodies, kin to her. She was no more herself, but all the world. Out of the infinitudes all came to her. Into the infinitudes sentient she spread. Infinity was her own natural home. Nowhere she dwelt, her spirit was everywhere. The distant constellations wheeled round her. Earth saw her born, all worlds were her colonies. The greater worlds of life and mind were hers. All nature reproduced her in its lines. Its movements were large copies of her own. She was the single self of all these selves. She was in them, and they were all in her. This first was an immense identity, in which her own identity was lost. What seemed herself was an image of the whole. She was a subconscient life of tree and flower, the outbreak of the honeyed buds of spring. She burned in the passion and splendor of the rose. She was the red heart of the passion flower, the dream white of the lotus in its pool. Out of subconscient life she climbed to mind. She was thought and the passion of the world's heart. She was the Godhead hid in the heart of man. She was the climbing of his soul to God. The cosmos flowered in her. She was its bed. She was time and the dreams of God in time. She was space and the wideness of his days. From this she rose where time and space were not. The superconscient was her native air. Infinity was her movement's natural space. Eternity looked out from her on time. End of Canto 7. End of Book 7. So then, namaste. Jai Ma.